Item number three is the judicial workload assessment updated case weights. This is an action item. And I'd ask the panel, as you speak, to please introduce yourselves. Thank you and welcome.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chief Justice.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, members of the council. I'm Dag McLeod. I manage the Office of Court Research here at the Administrative Office of the Courts. I'm very excited to be here today with Judge Stock, representative of the SB 56 Working Group, Leah Rose Goodwin, directly to my left, who is the lead and project manager of the Judicial Workload Assessment Update, and Dina Piazza, my collaborator and colleague from the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts. The report that you have before you today is the result of a tremendous collaboration between the trial courts and the AOC. In my office, we can crunch numbers until we're blue in the face, but those numbers won't be very useful and they won't be very meaningful unless we have the raw material that give them meaning and make them valid. And that raw material is data. And data is never cheap to get. It takes a lot of work, and the only way we can get it is by relying on the trial courts, the judges who participated in this study. Lee is going to talk a little bit more about how many judges, but I'll say at the outset, lots. A lot of judges, a lot of courts took a lot of time to participate in this study in order to make sure that we have meaningful numbers that we can use when we talk to the legislature about the needs in the courts. I like to believe that the reason so many courts participate in this study is that they saw the importance of the study. To a large degree, what this study does is it translates your experience, the experience of trial court judges, into the language of the Department of Finance and the legislature. It helps them understand, in terms that they work with, what the dire and critical need is for new judgeships in the superior courts. And if, as is most likely, we're not in a position of getting new resources, it can also be used defensively to demonstrate the important work that the courts are doing, and again, the dire and critical need for resources in the courts. So as a defensive measure to demonstrate to the legislature that we have a tremendous need for resources in the courts and we are not in a position to receive more cuts. One point that I want to make at the outset before turning it over to Judge Stock, one additional important thing that the judicial workload assessment does is it takes the politics out of the creation and allocation of new judgeships. In 2006, when the legislature created 50 new judgeships, it did something that was almost as important, if not more important, which is that it put into statute the fact that the judicial council will become responsible for telling the legislature where and how many judgeships are needed. In SB 56, the legislature said that, yes, we're going to create 50 new judgeships, and no, we're not ceding the responsibility for creating new judgeships, but the way that the legislature looks at the need for judgeships and where those judgeships are needed is using a model that is based on a methodology identical to the methodology that we used in creating the new case weights that are coming before you today. The final point I wanted to make was just a clarification regarding the update that we're presenting today and previous updates that we've done. In the past, we've come before the council updating the model, and those updates have been exclusively on the basis of new filings data. And by that, what I mean is that there are really two big components of the judicial workload assessment. We take filings data and we plug those filings numbers into workload assessments. By statute, we're required to update the model every 2 years, and we've come to the council on a number of occasions before updating the model using the new filings data. What's fundamentally different about this update today is that we've gone back and we've reassessed the amount of work required on average for each of those filings so that the underlying weighting is what's changing in this model today, and which is why it's taken so much work and we've had so much tremendous support from the trial courts in updating the model. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Judge Stock and...
Thank you, Dag. Chief and members of the council, thank you for having us here this afternoon. I'm Judge Nancy Stock, Orange County Superior Court. I think I was appointed to the working group for the judicial case weights and resource allocation because I'd done some hard time on the trial court budget working group, was a former presiding judge with the PJ Executive Advisory Committee, and just completed a tour on the Elkins Family Law Task Force, where we are now in the implementation phase. I think you're going to find that the product that is before you today represents a much more sophisticated and intuitive way of measuring judicial output and what is actually needed for judges to do the work in the particular types of cases that are involved. This working group was formed in August of 2009, and looking around the table at that time, I can say everybody brought their heavyweights. There were presiding judges, court executive officers, pretty much the A-team. This was an important enterprise, and it had interesting implications for everybody, both external to our branch and internal, that we properly allocate and understand what it means to have judges do work based upon case filings and what the staffing component would also be. Today we're here just on the judicial workload portion of it. Resource allocation is a separate stage. We had judicial officers and court executives from 15 counties representing both small and large courts from all regions of the state. At the first meeting, an overall research agenda was developed that centered on updating the judge and staff workload models, and as Dag mentioned, they were quite out of date, particularly in certain types of case filings, and we'll hear a little bit about that today, particularly in the family and juvenile area. We all agreed that new time studies should be conducted to update the estimates of time required, and these studies are done at the desk, in chambers, on the bench, actual judicial time spent. There are important limitations to tracking what judges do in the moment in their current environment, however under-resourced that may be. And so we felt that a time study alone would not be sufficient to accurately capture the need for judicial resources to be explained to the legislature. And so we took a couple of additional steps. But simply, the working group was committed to not just measuring a standard of mediocrity that would be perpetuated if, in fact, we did not have adequate resources, but we needed to take an additional step. So in addition to measuring the judges' outputs on the bench, in whatever fashion judges worked on certain kinds of cases, we took a couple of additional steps to adjust the time study estimates to make them more relevant. First, we took the same judicial officers in these study courts and had them complete a survey to assess where more time might be needed to improve on the quality of justice. Now, 175 judicial officers participated in this, and it was kind of a menu of activities. Do you need more case prep time? Do you need more time to explain things to the litigants? Do you need more time after a judgment is entered? Where do you need the time that you don't have now? And we saw some interesting differences as between felony trial judges and family law judges, for example, in what they felt they were clearly lacking on the job. The second thing we did was we went to a different set of judges and we conducted Delphi sessions, which were feedback sessions. And I know we sent from our court people who we felt were bringing their A game, our best judges who practiced at the height of their area in family, juvenile, and criminal and civil, so that they would have the right kind of feedback to provide if given a wish list of additional resources that they could use to do the job. So these case weights, how many minutes a judge might spend on a particular file over time, were tested and talked about by these Delphi session judges who then critiqued them. We had 44 judges in the room from 19 different courts on all different case types doing that. One example of the type of information that came from this second-tier process, where we put actual judges on the data to tell us if it really sung or did not sing, we found that 14 out of 24 judges who hold family law assignments indicated that they thought that more time was needed to conduct settlement conferences and to hold hearings. The idea that they would need more time to hold hearings is somewhat amazing, perhaps, but not when you consider some of the recommendations coming out of the Elkins Family Law Task Force calling for more oral testimony, more in-court time, and more evidence-taking in critical family matters, particularly in child custody. Significantly, our family law judges also reported that they felt that they needed more time to prepare. They didn't have the time on file that they needed, and they felt that they were kind of too much in the moment on the bench on these important matters. In the criminal area, our Delphi judges, our experienced judges, told us that they needed additional time with post-disposition activity, violation probation hearings, mandatory check-ins for drug court, restitution hearings, and other after-action activity, if you will, were absolutely necessary to keep people on the straight and narrow. And that's where they felt that they were shorted. We convened this last fall to review the draft judicial case weights after this feedback came about, and we approved the new case weights as indicated in your materials. We did have a series of conference calls in the late September period with research staff so we could all comment upon the new case weights. Some of the materials in your report today, including the new case weights and the implications of using these case weights, were presented to the Presiding Judges Advisory Committee and court executives. I think it's meaningful to note that our working group sent out a recommendation that the case weights be reviewed by those two bodies before they went any further because of the value of the kind of feedback we get from those organizations. So in short, we had about 23 courts participating. We had hundreds of judges providing direct feedback in the form of participating in the study, participating in a Delphi group, or participating after the study. I think what we have today is a more sophisticated and realistic assessment of what it takes to do a particular job in regard to taking a felony case from beginning to end or a juvenile case from beginning to end. There are other aspects of judicial work as it relates to different things that happen in different parts of the state. And so as we discussed various issues such as asbestos lawsuits or even the current iteration on criminal justice realignment or some of the reforms in Elkins family law or any other changes that have occurred in the last 10 years, we feel that this model can kind of grow with those changes and will serve to give us a stronger anchor in terms of assessing not only what we're going to ask the legislature for, but also what we need to do internally with our own leadership in terms of how we allocate resources in our court.
Thank you, Judge Stock, and good afternoon, Chief and members of the Council. So as Judge Stock mentioned, we had 23 courts participating in the judicial workload assessment, 15 in the crime study itself, and 8 additional courts that participated either as members of the SB 56 working group or in the Delphi sessions. And just to reiterate something Judge Stock said, this is a study, or the results of this study only pertain to the judicial workload side. We do have the staff workload study update, which was conducted right along the same times as the judicial workload assessment, but those results won't be presented until early spring of next year. I have a chart here that shows some comparative participation data between the 2001 and 2011 studies. We partnered with the National Center for State Courts on the time study data collection. And for this study, we were able to supplement NCSC's team with AOC staff in order to increase the number of courts that were able to participate in the study through more training support and study support. We had over double the number of judges participating in the study, 337, for a total of 533 judicial officers. That includes subordinate judicial officers, pro tems, and even assigned judges that were working in the study courts at the time of the time study. For the time study itself, judicial officers were asked to record their daily activities over a 4-week period, and it's a tracking system that many judges liken to keeping track of billable hours. Because there were so many participants, we collected a substantial number of time study minutes, over 37 million minutes of data. And over the next few slides, I'll illustrate why that quantity of data is important. The time study, again, was conducted over a 4-week period. It was late May, early June 2010, and I've represented that here on the slide in this red box. And we have very few cases that begin and end in a 4-week period corresponding with that time study collection period. So we can't really capture the totality of actions in a single case. So instead, what we do is study each case that a judicial officer works on during the study period. So if you imagine on this slide that each line represents the duration of a case and each dot represents an event in a case, our study captures data on the events and the activities that happen during the study period, which are marked here in yellow, again, the dots in the red box. For example, we may collect information about the arraignment in one case and post-judgment review in another. And if we have a large enough sample, then we get a good representation of all the case processing work that's required in a typical case. We take those minutes of time study data collected, so again, in the previous slide, the time in the red box, and we divide that by the average filings. The working group advised that we use a four-year average of filings, which helps smooth any year-to-year variations that we tend to see mostly in the smaller volume, yet high case, yet high weight case types like juvenile or probate. The case weights show the average time and minutes per filing that it takes judicial officers to process cases. So, for example, our proposed felony case weight is 177 minutes, meaning that on average, a felony case takes that much judge time from filing through post-disposition activity. Now, judges might look at that number and say, well, wait a minute, I just came from a six-week trial, and there's no way it took 177 minutes. It was much more than that. There is a tendency to recollect those egregious cases, the ones that took the longest time. But there is a very small proportion of cases that actually go to trial, somewhere in the range of 2 to 3%. The majority are resolving much earlier in the process. The time study captures that full range of case activity, from the long trial that on this chart would be in the far right to cases that are filed and are resolved in just one or two hearings. Attachment A of the report shows the case types and case weights that we've collected data on. We have 18 in the study and they're selected on the basis of two criteria. For one, we have to have filings data from the courts to back the case weights up because filings are our workload driver. Secondly, the case types reflect meaningful differences in workload. For example, it's clear that a felony case takes more time to resolve than an infractions case. We study that workload separately and assign them different weights accordingly. The case weights that we're currently using to assess judicial workload are 10 years old. And we know that in the intervening decade that there have been improvements in court technology, case management practices, there have been changes in law and rules of court that may increase or decrease the amount of time judicial officers need. For example, the case weight for felony declined about 10% from the previous study, and with criminal being the largest workload driver in the courts, the working group felt that felony appears to take less time because there's more case management practices applied to those cases. And also, the data for the previous study was collected in 1999, which was just after unification. It was a period of time when many courts may have still been doing bindovers and other practices that have since been phased out. The increases in the dissolution case weight and some of the civil case weights was attributed to increases in the number of pro per litigants and more procedural requirements since the previous study. Now, the case weights are most meaningful in the context of how many and where judges are needed. We use the three most recent years of filings data available, so that would be fiscal year 06-07 through 08-09, to calculate judicial need using the old case weights and then the new case weights. In this table, the first row of data shows the need using the old case weights, a statewide need for judges of 2,351. The next row shows the judicial need using the 2011 draft case weights. There's a statewide need now of 2,367. And since we use the same year of filings data with both sets of case weights, the change in need is entirely the result of the change in the case weights. So at the statewide level, new case weights show a minimal change in judicial need, an increase of 15.4 positions statewide. Nevertheless, the need for judges remains severe. Using the new draft case weights, statewide need is 345 positions above what is currently authorized. In attachment F to the report, we show the need for judicial officers by court and case type. This is the document we shared with the courts in late September, as Judge Stock mentioned. Because courts have different case mixes, with some having a greater proportion of criminal cases than others, courts may see a change in their judicial need numbers. Nevertheless, the new case weights still support a high overall need for judges statewide, particularly in the Central Valley and Inland Empire. We have three recommendations for the Judicial Council to consider today. The SB 56 Working Group recommends that the new case weights, the new 2011 judicial officer case weights be approved. And they also are recommending cleanup legislation to make it clear that judicial needs should be calculated on the basis of the updated case weights. And the third recommendation is that is a recommendation by AOC staff that the special assessment of the need for new judgeships in family and juvenile law be approved for transmittal to the legislature. And now Dina Piazza from the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts will talk about the special assessment in more detail and how it was integrated into the workload study.
Thank you, Leah. Good afternoon, Chief and members of the Council. So folded into this overall workload study was a special assessment for the need for new judgeships in family and juvenile law assignments, which is required pursuant to Government Code Section 69614. The full report is attached to the report as an appendix. Looking at the legislative history, the assessment was required in response to concerns that past studies have undercounted the time to properly handle family and juvenile law matters. So if the time was being undercounted, then it seemed like there could be the possibility for underestimating the resource needs in these areas. And I think advisory bodies such as the Blue Ribbon Commission on Children and Foster Care and the Elkins Family Law Task Force have also expressed a concern about underjudging in those areas. So one of the ways that we helped to fulfill the requirement of this code section was to extensively involve court and AOC subject matter experts in the study design, so designing the time study, looking at the questions that were asked and making sure that they were kind of appropriate for the non-litigation models that are employed in juvenile and family law. They were also involved in the quality adjustment process that Judge Stock described and the review of the results. Our subject matter experts had extensive knowledge of both current court operations and policy and practice directions in family and juvenile law, and they included several advisory bodies that have been working in the areas on an ongoing basis, such as, again, the Elkins Family Law Task Force, the Blue Ribbon Commission on Children and Foster Care, the Juvenile Delinquency Court Assessment Working Group, and the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee. We also involved judicial officers who had extensive family and juvenile law experience, but who might have been outside of those bodies, as well as AOC staff, particularly staff from the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts, who staff many of the working groups that were involved. Some of the special focus on family and juvenile included modifying some of the reporting categories to better reflect that many dispositions are reached not at trial, and a lot of post-disposition activity, which also, as Judge Schock mentioned, is increasing in criminal case types as well. The quality adjustments factored in recommendations of the advisory bodies, so they made upward adjustments in the time required, for example, to hear family law cases because of the requirement for more live testimony pursuant to Elkins. Additionally, with the inclusion of more courts in the study, we should generally improve our measurement of the workload involved in family and juvenile law because it should be a better representation of a wider variety of practices in these areas. And what the special assessment found briefly was that the time required to handle family and juvenile cases has increased since the last study. So those case weights have increased pretty much across the board. Courts reported needing more time to review files and prepare for hearings, to conduct hearings and including taking more testimony from the parties, and to make and explain findings and orders. And those factors varied a bit across family and juvenile, but those were kind of the common threads that led to the increases in time. And the other major finding is that family and juvenile law remains significantly under-resourced. As an adjunct to the time study, we conducted a census of judicial officer allocation in the middle of 2010, and it showed that there are far fewer judges than needed currently assigned to family and juvenile law, and I'll show some of the details on the next slide. So you can see that family law had about 140 fewer judicial officers per the 2010 census than the implied need suggested by the new study. Basically, family and delinquency needed about 60% more judicial officers than they currently had to meet the need, and dependency needed around 80% more. And I wanted to note that this is statewide. The degree of under-resourcing may vary from court to court depending on their mix of filings and how they've chosen to assign their judicial officers. The judicial officer census, though, is now a year and a half old. We're not sure how the assignments may have changed since then. We do know that some courts are losing commissioners and may need to shift assignments around. Additionally, the implied need will be recalculated with newer filings data after they're assuming they're approved today. So the numbers in either of these columns could change, but this should just give you a general flavor for the degree of under-resourcing in these areas. I also wanted to note that although this particular special assessment focuses on family and juvenile and the resource needs there, we do see resource needs in other case types as well. As we saw, the 345 needed statewide, that spread across a variety of case types. I think with that, we can open it up for discussion.
So we can open it up for discussion, or we can return to the recommendation.
Okay, Justice Hill and then Judge Wesley.
Thank you, Chief. I just wanted to note I'm slightly familiar with time and motion and workload studies. And as I read the materials, the work and the thought and the effort that went into this were truly commendable. I think it's excellent work. But as you noted, the raw material, of course, is the data and the difficulty of obtaining the data. What you've done has led to some very, in my view, very sophisticated estimates, but estimates nonetheless. And I don't really have a question. It's more in the nature of amusing, not amusing, I hope. In reading the materials, I did wonder whether or not, as we go forward in the future, whether or not you could, we as a branch could find some way for real-time capture of the amount of time that judges use through some use of CCMS. I'll say not when and if it's deployed, but when it's deployed, whether or not judges and such could report the time they spend, and so you wouldn't have to depend on sampling. It's well beyond our discussion here today, and I'm not familiar enough with the software to know if it could do that or if it could be revised to do that. We've lost Justice Bernier, as we still have Judge Herman and Ron here. But I'm not asking for a discussion on that. But it's perhaps another way where the branch, would not have to the next time around depend on samplings, but could depend on real-time reporting of all courts throughout the state. I might add, I can understand the resistance that was referred to by some judges in reference to timesheets. Having spent 16 years of my life with timesheets, I can appreciate that as perhaps a bit of a roadblock. But it's just something that I think maybe as the branch goes forward, maybe we can work on something along those lines.
Judge Wesley and then Chief Turner.
I didn't have enough time to really review this as much time as I would have liked, but I would ask you on, it's listed as my page 834, it's attachment F. I'm trying to understand what this tells me in light of what I just heard you talk about. At the bottom it has totals, and it says that with respect to family law, statewide, there's a minus 62.9, I guess that's positions, or minus 2.8%. What does that mean?
Oh, I'm going to give you the overview of what that means, and then Dina can talk details. What it means is that in 2001, when we created the case weights, we were not able to disentangle unlimited civil petitions from family law petitions. So many courts were reporting those two categories in the same area that what we had to do is we had to combine them and create a mashup case weight. So as a result of the inability to pull those two categories apart, we had a mashup case weight, which effectively was the same value for both unlimited civil petitions as well as the family law petitions. It gave a higher weight to family law than family law should have had, and a lower weight probably to the unlimited civil petitions than it should have had. That was a data challenge that we had at that time. And going forward, we continued to use that case weight. It's the only data we had. In disentangling those two, we got original data from the time study that showed that the reported time is actually considerably higher from judges in the family law area, but it's not as high as you would get if you mixed it in with the unlimited civil petitions. So Dina can talk a little bit about the precise numbers that we saw in the time study and the difference between those and the numbers that we saw in the time study in 2001. Does that begin to address your question?
Well, sort of. My question is this telling me that we have 62.9 too many judges assigned to family? And if it's telling me that, the practical experience tells me that this isn't accurate.
No. And let me actually take that one, too, before we get to the detail. What it's saying is that if we were to allocate all of, if we, first of all, if we had all of the judges we need statewide, which is 350 plus more than we have, if we had all of those judgeships, then they would be allocated in this way. This is showing the difference between what the previous model estimated where they would go and what our current numbers show where they would go. So it's purely a comparison between the previous model and the current model, not a comparison of actual judicial resources to the model.
So the previous model, if you compare it, your 2011 model says, for example, but does your 2011 model say we have 62 too many judges assigned to family?
Yeah. No.
Is that what it says?
No.
It's a model, but what does this model tell me?
It tells us that we need over 300 more judgeships than we need statewide. And it allocates those by case types. And the reason why it allocates those by case types is because different cases take different amounts of time. So to some extent, what we're doing is we're documenting the different amounts of time. What the previous model said, based on a data error, was that family law needed the number of judicial officers that we show in the column for the previous model. This is comparing the current model to the previous model. And by subtracting out those 62 judgeships, it's saying that statewide we need 62 fewer in that area than the previous model would have shown. So that number... Can you show... Do you have that slide that shows the comparison between the... It's in the attachment. You can look at what the actual comparison is. The comparison of the actuals to the current.
An attachment, yeah.
Using our draft case weights, we would need 377 judicial officers in the family law area, and we don't have that many in family law.
It was 440 before.
It might be on page.
And now it's...
or the church.
Now it's... Well, minus 62.9.
On the back.
377.
So we need fewer than we needed before, but we still need more than we currently have. Is the bottom line
by about 140 judicial officers.
So there are approximately, according to the 2010 census, about 240 judicial officers assigned to family law, and this model says we need about 380. So this is basically saying we have a deficit of 140 judicial officers statewide in family law.
Okay. I think that's what it says. I just didn't see it.
Kim, and then Judge Rosenberg.
Thank you, Chief. I just wanted to make a comment on Justice Hull's remarks about, you know, how the data is an estimate, and, you know, it's unfortunate that we don't have a way to collect sort of real-time data as we go forward. I'm a member of the SB 56 working group, and so we have many, many discussions about this early on, how we were going to collect reliable data and so forth. And I think the really telling part of the analysis here is this 33 or 35 million minutes, something, some astronomical number of minutes that I can hardly even wrap my head around. And from my old days, you know, statistics 101 and the work that I do in the court, I will tell you that as you start to collect more data, the data becomes more reliable because you are basically washing out a lot of the outliers and collecting a large volume of data. So whereas in 2001, I think we collected something like 5 million minutes, now we collected 35 million minutes, I think that the integrity of the data goes up with the higher data collection activity. So I just wanted to say that while, you know, obviously in a perfect world we'd collect information real time and all the time and so forth, I think it would be hard to do that in any case management system, but I am pretty darn impressed with how much data we did get out of the SB 56 study. And so just wanted to add that little bit of perspective. And I also wanted to ask, I know that, and I can't remember if it's part of this government code section related to the family law special assessment requirements, but I know that there is consideration given to courts who convert commissioner positions to family law judgeships. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, how successful that's been, how many of those judgeships have been created as a result of this.
I think it's SB 405 that makes the conversion of subordinate judicial officers to full judgeships, and that becomes effective on January 1. We've actually converted two positions under that new provision in this fiscal year, and they'll become effective on January 1 when the law becomes effective.
Judge Rosenberg.
Thank you very much, particularly Judge Wiebenstock, who's kind of our all-purpose workhorse on so many projects. But I have one question and then one thought. The question is, did this study encompass time spent by judges on management, administration, continuing education, conferences, things of that nature? Was that part of the study?
It's part of the assumed amount of time that judges need to spend doing things other than case
What does
processing.
That mean, assumed amount of time?
If you build a model, you need to assume that there's a certain number of minutes available to do work. You can't come up with an estimate for how long it takes to do something until you've said, okay, here's how many minutes are available. The judge workload day is assumed to be 6 hours of case processing-related activity. So the remaining 2 hours in an eight-hour day are devoted to any range of other things. Now, it's not 2 hours in every day.
So let me stop you there. You assume trial judges spend 6 hours in their courtroom work?
That's what the model, that's the underlying parameter of the estimate.
The model is defective from the get-go.
Yeah.
I start my day at 7. I mean, judges don't spend 6 hours in courtroom work. They spend a lot more than that.
Then
I'd like to meet the judge that spends 6 hours on courtroom work. Putting that aside, did you consider realignment and the effect on of realignment?
We have had a couple of conversations about realignment. We couldn't measure realignment because it hadn't occurred. We have $17 million that the legislature has already provided for dealing with some of the immediate impact of realignment. So what we're hopeful of doing is going forward, being able to keep the model updated by looking at realignment as one of the items that we would say, you know, this is absolutely on us right now, is something we need to reconsider in our next update of the model. But for the immediate purposes of this model, we don't have realignment built into it.
I just had a follow-up comment on Judge Rosenberg's comment relative to the judicial day. Many of us debated exactly what you had just mentioned, that our actual workday, particularly these days, is far greater than 6 hours, and it's divided in different segments, including maybe some time at home in front of the fireplace with a glass of Chardonnay, but that's different. The question was, did we want to build a model that assumed a 10-hour judicial workday? Is that the model we wanted to build? So even though many of us are putting in the 10-hour judicial workday, it wasn't the model that we wanted to create. And the actual judicial workday did come up because a number of people around the room, including the judicial officers, suggested that we spend a lot more time on that. But there was a self-check through the National Center of State Courts as to what other judicial model days looked like, sort of bench time, and this model actually coincided with that. So that gave us some comfort that we weren't outliers or underliers. But the question was, do we want to build a 10 to 12-hour day model and thus reduce the number of judgeships that might come to the court? So that kind of settled it for us.
I understand. Well, certainly you don't want to build a 10 or 12-hour model, but 6 hours, I would question that. You know, the work you're doing is important and necessary and required under SB 56, but it's all hollow, to be honest with you, unless the legislature and the governor provides the funding. I mean, we had 50 new judgeships created in 2008, and here we are about to enter into 2012, and they're still not funded. And that's just the first 50. So we're building up a deficit over time of judicial officers, which will be very hard to fill 5 years from now.
Your Honor, just a point of correction. The first 50 were funded. Right. So we got 50 judgeships funded. The second 50.
I'm talking about the 50 that are still out there and not funded.
Indeed.
Right. Miriam Krinsky, do you have a comment? And then Judge, you.
Yeah. This question, Deanna, is for you on the dependency part of the family dependency delinquency. I didn't see it in here, and I'm just wondering if I missed it or if, similar to realignment, it's sort of there, but no way for us yet to say anything about it, which is to what extent you tried to factor in the change in the law that is going to phase in over time more judicial hours by virtue of the fact that now we're going to continue, hopefully, you know, in growing numbers, to supervise youth in foster care up to age 21. So we know that we're going to have this growing population of youth that are going to remain on the judicial caseloads longer and in the system longer. And that's a good thing in terms of the youth, but it's going to put enhanced workload pressures. So if it wasn't considered, because similar to realignment, we just can't capture it yet, I'm wondering whether on both of those issues there's any way to kind of plant a footnote or sort of, you know, ring a little warning bell saying we realize it is what it is as of now, but there are a couple of these things that are going to have a huge impact in the coming years, and here's what they are.
I would say that's actually something that came up. Of course, we couldn't measure it in the time study, but it is something that came up during the Delphi groups. And to the extent that the judicial officers who participated in those groups could anticipate what the impact would be, then it actually did increase the case weight at that point. So it was in that quality adjustment process. But I do think it's one of those things that we're going to have to be mindful of, along with realignment, along with some of the Elkins, because you know, we're really only estimating what the additional impact can be. And in future time studies, we may see it as it becomes more institutionalized.
So on all of those, and I think Elkins is obviously another one of those areas, is there any thought of maybe putting, you know, in whatever document issues these, just sort of a proviso that we're fully aware that there are a couple things down the track that are going to have an influence, and we're just going to keep watching them over time. But here's what they are: realignment, Elkins recommendations, and, you know, increasing supervision of youth up to age 21. Those are out there. They're clearly going to have consequences. We're well aware of them, and they just need to be watched over time.
Yeah. And I think that's something we can certainly add as a footnote to the report that we submit to the legislature, just sort of future developments that could impact the need.
Judge Yu, and then Alan Carlson.
As one of those juvenile dependency court judges that had to do those timesheets in May and June of 2010, and also as someone who chaired the workload subcommittee of my court and used the old information, it's so nice to see this report, because those little incremental inputs that we made really show a bigger picture. And like any study or report, it's a snapshot in time. It can't encompass everything, but it's actually, I think, a good job, and much better than the information we had before. So thank you so much.
2 points. In the report on the family and juvenile, there's a continual reference back to how many judges we should have versus how many we actually have. And that's a legitimate number. The problem I have is that nobody has as many judges as we're supposed to have. So the implication that somehow we've shorted family more than other places, you can't tell when you use the number of what we should have versus what we actually have. Somehow you need to have a paragraph that says, okay, we're 80% of what we should have, so what would 80% of family court share be, and where is that relative to the what we actually got? And I suspect it's not as far off. It's still not enough, maybe. But that number to me is more important right now in managing the court than it is to say, well, if someday we got all the ones we wanted,
right,
and where actually, should we be?
If you look at figure 3 in that report, the middle bar is, I'm not sure what page it is. I just have it as a standalone.
20.
Page 20.
Page 20, okay. So this actually shows the middle bar, the red bar, shows what the expected allocation would be if we applied it to the current number of judgeships that we have. So proportionally, it looks like 16% of judicial officers should be assigned to family law. If we applied the 16% to the number that we currently have, we would expect 319 judicial officers.
Yeah, that to me is the more bothersome number right now.
Right.
The 378 is kind of out there. The second point is, and I say this every time, I always will with weighted caseload, the reason we can't answer the questions about the other ones is because of the basic model we use can't do that. And we need to find a model that can. And I think those models exist. So I just keep saying that as long as we're going to keep using this model, that it doesn't work for us when we want to make projections. Mm-hmm. But there are models out there that could, and we ought to be looking at that, particularly now when we're not getting any judgeships anyway. I think we have a little hiatus to do some work to find a better model that would allow us to do some projections in that sense.
Thank you. Kim Turner.
Sorry, I want to go back to the comment that Judge Rosenberg made about the 6 hours of work in a judicial day and just expand a little bit on Judge Stock's comment, because I'm remembering from the early conversations in SB 56, the way that we determined a six-hour workday, in addition to sort of vetting that against the National Center data, was that we looked at the number of minutes in a judicial year, am I getting this right, and that we actually said, okay, in a judicial year there are so many thousands of minutes, and of those minutes, judges are entitled to 28 vacation days a year, and so those minutes were deducted, and then judges go to X number of conference days a year and training days a year and so forth. And so I think that what you get then is you start with the total number, you reduce it by these other days, and then you spread that over the entire, you know, remaining number of days, and that's how you get to that 6 hours. It's actually not 6 hours, assuming that, you know, or implying that 2 other hours you're just kind of sitting around with nothing to do. It's that your number of actual productive minutes in a judicial year are actually fewer than 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Am I right about that? Okay. I just didn't want that impression to be kind of hanging out there that number was sort of plucked out of the air. I think there was some science behind it.
Justice Baxter?
I do think... perhaps this report could find its greatest benefit in the governor's office if used to establish the point that attorneys in the family law field are really underrepresented in terms of judicial appointments. I know when I first started practicing law, the family law judge was always the rookie. He may have been the greatest trial attorney in the county, but since he or she, usually he at that time, was the rookie, became the family law judge, didn't know the first thing about it, and had to learn on the job, and was so anxious to get out of that assignment to do general civil trials. I'm not so sure governors appreciate the fact that the caseload in our current courts is as heavy as it is in the family law and dependency and related areas. And I think that's important information for someone to communicate to the appointing authority, not only in terms of the recruitment process, but also in terms of the appointment process. So much focus in the appointment process is based on, well, gee, how many jury trials has this person had, you know, as a DA or as a public defender or as a civil litigator. And generally speaking, those who have not had that type of jury trial experience don't fare nearly as well as those that do. So I'm not so sure that it's the responsibility of the Judicial Council to make that case, but perhaps this report could be made available to those who would advocate on behalf of family law lawyers, both in the recruitment and the appointment process. I think it may be a lot more helpful in that area than it would be in terms of immediately getting a lot of new appointments, a lot of new judgeships.
I could just comment, Justice Baxter, all trial judges are rookies. When they're first appointed, they're never appointed in their area of expertise. So we could be appointing a lot of family lawyers, and they're going to wind up doing probate or criminal. You know, as a civil practitioner, it was a great shock to me to get on the bench and immediately get a criminal calendar. But that's just the way it goes.
Any more questions or comments? So I'm going to call the question. I think that's the right person.
What is the motion?
That's right. Do I hear a motion on the recommendation made? Judge O'Malley.
Right. I would move to adopt the three recommendations that we see on page 2 of the report.
Thank you.
Second.
You, Kenzo. Judge So, second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Matter carries. Thank you, Judge Wiebenstock. Thank you, Dag. Thank you, Leah. Thank you also, all of you. I know you didn't all introduce yourselves, but also thank you, Ms. Piazza. Incredible work. Very helpful. Thank you. A useful tool for the judicial branch to move forward a complicated matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.